Welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast, Identify the Hidden Drivers, Part 2 of 3. Hi, I'm Nathan Ives. Along with my co-host, Lucas Ives, we would like to welcome you to this edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast. Identify the Hidden Drivers, Part 2 of 3. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag posts found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. This podcast continues our discussion of the best practice of identifying hidden performance drivers during a strategic analysis, thereby enabling the organization to focus its efforts on mission goal achievement through elimination of distractors and propagation of constructive behavior reinforcers. So now, without any further delay, let's get started.
Okay, well, how about then some examples of undocumented drivers?
Okay. Well, undocumented drivers are typically an integral component of an organization's history and culture, or are a result of an individual's self-interest. And there goes that hot topic that we talked about.
That's right.
Yeah. So I'm going to save that one to the end.
Okay.
Okay.
Keep the edge of our seats then.
Yeah, I'm going to keep you waiting. And then we're going to talk about some, and I'll, you know, I'm going to try to keep it to something that's very public and, you know, the public is very much aware of, but it's just an area we do have to cross.
Okay.
But at a high level, just an overview of what we're going to talk about in these next examples for undocumented drivers. We have undocumented reasons for the organization's founding. This is going to be an interesting one. Mm-hmm. We have organizational legacy. We have success-driven complacency, personal relationships, or a lack thereof.
Okay.
The next ones I call defer to perceived important groups or individuals, unspoken values, again, a kind of a cultural one, mm-hmm. and that last one, personal agendas. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, to start out with, undocumented reasons for the organization's founding. Okay, sometimes, beyond an organization's mission statement, the reason for its creation is understood and acted on by the board of directors and or a small select group of the senior leadership team. Get rooted in the organization's history. This undocumented purpose guides decision-making at the top of the organization, even when it apparently is contradictory to the organization's stated mission. Now, when this occurs, not only is the mission's achievement diminished by the direction set, but there exists a risk of creating conflicting priorities for managers and individual contributors that, one, further limit their effectiveness, but also can create some confusion within the organization, which causes a lot of lost time as people wonder, why are we pursuing this? Or how come that policy's been put into effect? Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen this very predominantly in a membership organization. Now, the organization was originally created to provide cost-saving services for its founders. Over time, the company evolved, it got bigger, and then it created a mission. Now, the mission developed by the company leadership described the services that were being provided, but it didn't say anything about the cost savings that those services were to provide the member organizations, those that founded it. Mm-hmm. In fact, it said something very different. Its mission indicated that the organization would provide premium services, which by their very nature were going to have a very high cost. So, in this example, cost savings for the members became an undocumented reason for the organization's founding. It was the piece that was left off. As time went on and the organizations and its services matured, it became evident by the decisions made by the board of directors and the executive team that there was this influence of the undocumented organization purpose. The company would in many cases take action that precluded it from excelling at achieving its mission, the mission of providing these premium and premier services. And instead of providing premium services, it would provide minimalist or kind of a just enough service. And then in other cases, it provided services that were well outside of its defined mission, its defined purpose. And it did so because doing so fulfilled the cost-saving needs of the member organizations. It fulfilled the undocumented purpose for the organization's founding.
You could almost call that their hidden agenda.
That's right. On an organizational scale.
Yeah, on a large scale, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. So that again, you know, most organizations are outwardly there to make a profit and benefit their stakeholders. So this one tends to be a little bit more toward, you know, a membership organization, something that doesn't have quite the same profit driver that the others do.
Okay.
Okay. All
right. You mentioned organizational legacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's our next one. Organizational legacy speaks to the history, especially history rich in tradition and heroes, and the actions people take in an attempt to live up to or remain faithful to that legacy. Holding on to these paths, methodologies, and philosophies might actually reduce the organization's efficiency in achieving its goals, especially in today's rapidly changing, highly technologically driven market environment. I like to call this also the "we've always done it this way" or "business as usual" syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I know we've both heard that a lot of times.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone hasn't. You know, and fundamentally, people hold on to what they're comfortable to, and it's natural to some degree to resist change. And so, for an example here, I've seen where a company had employees fill out paper timesheets. And I don't know if you've had experience filling out paper timesheets. I have.
I have myself, but, too. And it's, well, just time-consuming and very antiquated, to say the least.
Yeah. Oh, well, certainly. Especially in light of today's time management systems, where you just record your time and it electronically logs it mm-hmm. in the system and tracks your vacation and everything. Well, it wasn't that this company did not have those systems, because in fact they did. However, they were holding on to a process where the employees would log their time on a timesheet, the manager would review the timesheet and approve it, And then an administrative assistant had to enter the time into a computer system. Yeah. And so as I probed into the, well, why are we doing that? You know, if people, instead of writing their time on a timesheet, actually just entered it into the computer system, and then the manager would have to go and approve it before making it an official record, there could be an elimination of that administrative overhead we're having, you know, in the admin assistance efforts to log or document the time in the system. And, you know, there's a level of error that you'd eliminate also, because the admin assistant's work wasn't then subsequently approved by the manager. The admin assistant could, you know, unintentionally, of course, make an error and introduce, you know, another error into this whole process. Well, the response I got was really a, we've always done it this way response. And the response was, to be fair, or to be honest, a very defensive response. This organization had a very deeply rooted tradition or practice in doing paper timesheets. And the management team had always done paper timesheets. The workforce had always done paper timesheets. And by golly, they were going to continue to do paper timesheets. So that's kind of an organizational legacy.
Yeah, it sounds like some of those may have some personal egos keeping those legacies alive as well.
Well, yeah, that too. And while maybe not kind of that conscious, you know, kind of greed that we're going to talk about later, there is, I think, a bit of a subconsciousness that we all have in protecting our own jobs. And we can view these computer systems and automation as putting our jobs at risk. Mm-hmm. And so subconsciously, we resist the change for that almost self-preservation kind of mode of thinking.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Luke, hey, this next one is very much related to the organizational legacy, and I call this success-driven complacency. This one is where organizations experience long periods of continuous success, and over time, they start kind of losing the sense that they need to question their processes, and they stop seeking improvements or change because they believe they represent the industry benchmark or standard for good performance. Now, today's highly competitive marketplace really leaves these organizations behind. They are very vulnerable to being overtaken by today's really aggressive competitors. Like I said, it's a lot like the previous example, but instead of holding on to a past practice because we've always done it this way, the reason morphs a little bit. The reason comes, we've always been successful at doing it this way. So success is linked to that reason why we're doing it, and so it can be even harder to change this particular driver.
Because from the outside, it seems to just make sense.
It does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think our example for this one, it really illustrates the case well. And again, I'm going to stay with a public example.
Okay.
With this, and I think our readers or our listeners are going to recognize this. And this is the case of Compaq versus Dell. Compaq Computer, coming up in the '80s and up to the early 90s, was really the superstar of computer manufacturers. They were making IBM clones. They were leaders in coming up with innovative products and really had the lion's share of the market. They were the standard. But their model was this. They made large inventories of pre-manufactured computers, and they sold them in large part, not entirely, but in large part in retail outlets. Now in the early 90s, along comes Dell Computers. Dell brings with it a new way of thinking and a new business model. Mm-hmm. They introduce the concept of mass customization. They're going to, through mass customization, let a person online order their computer or over the phone, and they're going to make the computer to exactly the specification of the person ordering the machine. And then they're going to ship it to that person. They're going to get it in a couple of days. So it's going to be a quick turnaround as well. Compact does not change its business model to match. It continues to follow the business model that made it successful. And over the course of the next decade, that being through the 90s and into the new century, Dell Computer becomes the number one computer retail source in the world. It had a new model.
I remember.
And Compact. Yeah.
And it seems as if they came out of nowhere, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was just some little outfit that was putting computers together and shipping them to people's homes. Mm-hmm. And it changed the way most of us buy computers today. And now we see Dell computers everywhere.
Yeah.
But again, I would call that a case of success-driven complacency. Certainly, Compact had the name recognition. They had all the branding. They had talented executives and certainly a talented workforce. They had created this just impressive company. And just as quickly, it was taken away from them. And they just did not adapt to what Dell was doing, the new model in the marketplace. And so that's our example of success-driven complacency.
And I guess just to put an exclamation point on that, Compaq had since been purchased by Hewlett-Packard, so
mm-hmm.
We see what happened to them in the long run. That's a great example.
Yeah. They went from the acquirer to being acquired. So the next one, moving us along, is personal relationships or the lack thereof. Now, people tend to identify and form relationships with those they perceive are like themselves. This may result then in the endorsement of actions and recommendations of one individual over another for relationship reasons, rather than as a result of an objective assessment.
Hmm.
Okay. On occasion, that relationship-based selection will also result in a lower value option being pursued. So here's I'm gonna give two examples that I've seen in this area. The first one really focuses on the identifying with those like us, and it comes from an example of hiring. There are occasions where a hiring manager will identify with a particular candidate, maybe, and here's just a common one that I see, because they went to the same college that the candidate went to. So in other words, we're both graduates of, you know, State University ABC, and I relate to this person. And this person may not be my most qualified candidate, but I relate to them because of the university they went to, and so I hire that person. Now, that's maybe a bit of a subconscious case. It becomes just so far, far worse when it's based on race and gender and age or other personal factors, which is really discrimination.
Right. Unfortunately, we see too much of that.
And unfortunately, we do see too much of that. We certainly do. I wish we were beyond that, but we are not. We are clearly not there yet. To a very similar circumstance for our second example. Often, especially amongst executive teams, we as a team make decisions. I have witnessed occasions where executives will look particularly at a newly hired executive and will just summarily dismiss that person's input or contribution to the decision process because, well, you know, they're the new person. Again, this takes on a far worse, you know, perspective when that dismissal is racially, gender, or age, or other, you know, personal trait factor, because then it just becomes discrimination.
Right.
But I do see that, but the common case is of the new hire, they just don't understand how we do it here. And, you know, I use an executive decision as an example, but it happens at all levels of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So personal relationships and identifying more with people who are like ourselves. The next undocumented hidden driver is defer to perceived important groups or individuals. Now, whether real or not, some groups or individuals tend to be perceived within an organization as being more critically important to the organization than other groups. And so it's these other groups then that tend to abdicate their role in the decision-making process to these, you know, critically important groups. What really hurts, though, is when that happens, even when these supporting groups have responsibility or just simply greater knowledge and experience in the area that the decision is being made on. So in this example, you know, what I often see is a deferral to what I'll call the line organization, and that could be like production or operations, as it's sometimes called,
mm-hmm.
engineering, maintenance, especially by support organizations. And those might be human resources, finance, or IT. So here goes the example. I often see in cases where we're going to implement like a technology solution, some new software, that IT will abdicate input into the decision-making process to the line organization. The line organization is making a decision because, you know, maybe there's some flashy option or there was a smooth salesperson. Where the IT organization is looking at this problem and they see, hey, I have other options. These options serve the functionality the line organization defined as being needed. And their unique knowledge and experience, this particular application that has all our required functionality fits better with our portfolio of software applications, and it's something we have experience with and can actually better support and maintain than this flashy solution that the line organization says that they want.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, all too often, the organization buys the flashy piece of software that the line organization said that they wanted. And so we have a deferral of the decision process to the line organization. And so that can be detrimental. That can be really detrimental. And again, the hidden driver is just we have a pecking order. Our perception is that there's a pecking order of importance for different organizations or business units within our organization.
Right. And I've seen that as well in my experience.
Uh-huh.
Even those who have the knowledge but maybe don't have the confidence in their own ability, and they'll defer it to someone who really doesn't deserve that level of responsibility or doesn't have that expertise even.
Yes. Oh, that's a great point. That's a great point. Level of confidence is very key here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. Luke, the next one on our list is unspoken values.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Valuing certain behaviors or personal characteristics may serve to personally benefit a majority of the organization members. And so over time, kind of becomes part of their culture. And so I guess let me jump into the example.
Okay.
And I think this one will be become clear then. The example that comes to mind that I see most prevalently is tenure. So we have an organization that has very low turnover and very high tenure. So now we have a new person come into the organization. The new person may be more qualified and more knowledgeable, but they're less tenured. And so we dismiss their fresh ideas, their new perspectives, because, well, they're the new person. You know, it benefits, you know, the majority of this organization, because they're highly tenured, to value tenure, to reward tenure in the way of promotion and compensation rather than performance, because it's the one way that the majority of the organization can, I guess you could say, defend itself from these minority groups, this, you know, untenured or new hire group that might be more knowledgeable and have higher performance. So it's very unconscious, but I've seen it happen, and I mentioned tenure because I see it happen most there. Is the organization starts to value tenure, and you do. You see promotions, you see compensation, you see a whole lot of rewards around tenure, not performance. And you see a lot of great performance amongst lower tenured persons, and yet it goes unrecognized just because that's not what the organization values or has come to value. I'd like to mention here too, in the case of tenure, on this example, this tends to drive up attrition. And these highly tenured organizations, when they look at their attrition, the attrition tends to come from those people who have the lowest tenure because they don't feel valued. And so as you're trying to bring people into your organization, you know, to replace people who are retiring, for instance, in many industries today, mm-hmm. you see this high attrition from these new people, and it's simply because they don't feel valued. So not only is the organization losing out because it's giving up the opportunity to get these new ideas on how to improve organizational performance, they're losing high performers, and long term, they're losing the ability to sustain their organization because the people who are supposed to replace the retirees are leaving.
Right.
So
I can definitely see how that's detrimental. You know, I'm starting to see too how some of these drivers feed into each other. How, for example, the more tenured individuals might be those
yeah.
same mm-hmm. individuals who just need to hold on to that organizational legacy, filling out the timesheets,
right.
for example. They don't want to change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are absolutely right. And, you know, it speaks to a bit of an undercurrent, a lot of these, to what is going to be our last one, and that's the personal agenda.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these speak to, you know, what's going to benefit for me? And unspoken values, well, they become unspoken organizational values because they benefit the majority of the organization. But when you talk about these organizational legacies, you know, usually there's a value not to change. You know, I'm so accustomed to doing this way. If I change, I might not be as proficient at doing it, and my performance may look like it's declined.
And
so, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's common threads through all these.
Yeah, and that self-preservation that you mentioned earlier ties in here with I think all of these.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. That was a great point there, you know, that you bring up, that there's a common thread through all of these. Which I think gets us to our last one.
The personal
And
agendas.
yeah, this is the hot topic one.
I've been waiting for this one.
Yeah. Well, we've held off long enough on this one, so let's go for it. Let's go for it. Personal agendas. You know, these really represent the hidden agendas of individuals, often seeking to enhance their own prestige and influence, or to protect their position, or expand their span of control, regardless of the overall organizational impact. And that's key. They are doing this, and they know it, that it's hurting the organization, and they're doing it anyway. This is all about me. So some of these others, the difference between this and some of the others is that we do it on maybe somewhat of a self or an unconscious self-preservation level. This one is done knowingly. Okay. These are ego-driven power struggles. And, you know, when that happens, it can irreparably damage an organization, and it can result in missed opportunities because of the roadblocks erected by, you know, those who don't stand to significantly benefit from action taken. And just to relate back to a podcast interview that we did with Diana McLean Smith, in her book, this speaks just directly to Apple Computer and the struggles that they had through the 90s. And, you know, they're wrestling back and forth. It was a power struggle, and it damaged that company until just recently, where of course Steve Jobs has taken over again.
Right, and they seem to be back
Yeah.
on track.
And they've gotten themselves back on track, but the years and the financial cost was huge. That's not our example. That's not our example. Our example is, I think, something that everyone will recognize, and our example is Enron.
Oh, yes.
So here we had a couple of self-serving executives that, you know, to say they acted unethically wouldn't begin to touch on it. They acted criminally, and they are being criminally punished right now. And they did so knowingly and for their own personal benefit. And so just to recap what they did, they falsified the financial statements of the company in order to inflate stock prices, which really enriched them. So this was a greed thing. It enriched them because they then sold those shares that they had at those inflated prices. And of course, as all things come to pass, you know, you can't hide a lie forever. And the inaccurate financial statements were uncovered. Stock prices plummeted. We had employees, we had private citizens, just huge numbers of people lost just vast amounts of money. Some people were just fully devastated. They lost all their retirement savings and everything because they had them in Enron stock. And again, you know, I know that's an extreme case, but you know, there's other less significant acts that are committed by many every day who are seeking to, again, serve their own personal gain, whether it's prestige, influence, wealth, control, and they just don't care about the expense to the organization or to others.
And although we don't like to think that these things happen, of course we all know that they do, especially Enron really hit the news when that broke. It's
Oh
unfortunate
yeah,
that it
and
does.
it has so devastated so many industries. I mean, I saw the stock prices of a lot of utilities decline. Of course, the respect that consulting firms had was tarnished. We've seen the government take action in the way of the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation that has cost, you know, organizations millions of dollars to comply with. Just just huge sums of money. So, you know, these folks, when they did this, they didn't just damage their own organization. They damaged so many others. I failed to mention, you know, even the respect or confidence in the stock market.
Yes.
You know, just the personal wealth and financial well-being of so many people were just so hurt through no fault of their own. So, yeah, I get upset when I find that these things happen. But, of course, you know, we're unfortunately all human, and these things do occur.
Mm-hmm. True.
And that wraps up Identify the Hidden Drivers, part 2 of 3. As always, we hope you enjoyed this edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast and would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. Note that additional information regarding strategic analysis is contained within the Strategic Analysis White Paper, accessible by registered members on the Strategy Driven website. Registered members also gain access to the many other Strategy Driven White Papers, models, and members-only categories, and registration is always free. So until next time, so long.